Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One here on Sunday, May the 2nd. I cannot wrap my head around the fact that it is already May of the second year of the pandemic, which I think mercifully is slowly coming to end. I think we're starting to see some daylight at the end of that tunnel. But that said, we've got a Grand Prix to talk about. And it's funny, man, because I watched the race this morning and I was just like, it wasn't that great. And I listened to some podcasts throughout the day and I read some race reviews. And I'm like, maybe it was better than I thought. And I actually went back and revisited the race this afternoon. And it wasn't actually a bad race. There was some really meaty stuff that happened. And I think if there's a takeaway for me from this Grand Prix, and we've got lots to talk about, I think it's that tiny margins are going to have some really significant impacts on the way that this season plays out. And by that, I mean, over the past 7 years, even when the top teams made small mistakes, it didn't necessarily have a big impact on the outcome of the championships, because ultimately Mercedes were so far and away better than everybody else in the field. But I think what we're seeing this year is, because there's so much parity, particularly amongst those top two teams, that small mistakes can have a big impact on the outcome of the championship. And we'll get into this, but very specifically, Max didn't have a bad weekend, but he had three very specific errors that certainly played into the outcome of this weekend. You know, obviously he had a lap time deleted in qualifying, which cost him being position number one, having pole for the race weekend. And if he'd had pole, maybe he would have won. He ultimately made a mistake in an effort to get past Bottas, which allowed Hamilton to get past him, which possibly cost him the race win. And then finally, on the last lap of the race, when he was going for fastest lap to pick up that one championship point that could have a big outcome on the end of the season, again, he made a mistake and the lap time was deleted. But I think overall, it was an entertaining Grand Prix weekend. And Nico Rosberg had made a comment today, and I don't specifically remember where it was, but it was basically to the tune that, I quote unquote, I think Max Verstappen is just beginning to understand how good Lewis really is. And I think the weekend absolutely reflected that. What were your thoughts?
I agree with absolutely everything that you said, and I think we can wrap this one up in under 3 minutes. Thank you all for tuning in. But joking aside, yeah, you know, it was a fascinating weekend, and I totally agree. I mean, if there was such a big gap in the terms of where Mercedes is compared to everyone else, why would they be squabbling over that stupid single point for fastest lap at the end of the race that went from Perez to Bottas to Max, and then ultimately, like you say, he had his time deleted for exceeding track limits at turn 14, and then it reverts back to Valtteri Bottas. So, you know, I think what you said was really accurate in the fact that this season is really going to come down to the details, right? There's like just a razor thin line in the differences between where these teams are at, Red Bull and Mercedes, because if you look at the Drivers' Championship right now, so it's 2-1 in terms of race victories for Lewis compared to Max. Lewis on top with 69 points, Max second with 61. Then you look at the Constructors' Championship. Okay, there's a bit more of a gap there. Mercedes on top with 101, Red Bull with 83. So a little bit more of a gap there, but we still have probably, hopefully, 20 races to go. So this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And if we keep going at the way that this is going over the first month and a half of the season, this could be a really good indication of how this season is going to play out over the long term. And what you were just remarking about Nico Rosberg, Lewis's former teammate and also a world champion back in 2016, is I think one of the best comments that was made all weekend, because you pointed out the number of errors that Max made over the different sessions that made up this race weekend that just put him at a disadvantage. And maybe under any other circumstances, maybe it wouldn't have been so bad. But then again, he hasn't been in this position to fight with Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes. But and Nico, and this was, I think he said this to Sky Sports after the race. But anyways, what Nico basically summed up is that, you know, if you want to take on Lewis Hamilton, it's one thing to be good. But if you want to take on Lewis and beat him, you have to be better than perfect, because this is a guy that rarely, if ever, makes any mistakes. But
absolutely,
he made one today, though. which was very interesting because it was quite something. I mean, I thought it was the start of the race was very fascinating because you had that little bit of a squabble at the start. I thought all three of the first three, four cars started very good, except for Perez, who had some wheel spin and didn't really get off the line good. But Bottas a good start, and Max and Lewis got off the line. Max ultimately taking that position, overtaking Lewis for P2 at the beginning there. And then right away we get to the end of the first lap. Kimi Raikkonen, most experienced guy in Formula One, has a bit of both halves of his brain fused together momentarily or something, but I think maybe he just got caught out by how much toe he had when his teammates started to move over. But
exactly,
still,
exactly.
That being said, he still managed to tag Giovinazzi's left rear tire with the outside of his wing. Safety car, right? So that kind of flips everything on its head. So we, have several laps behind the safety car, and then is back to racing. And it was just kind of interesting to see how things all played out. And Bottas, I kept going back and thinking about, one of the many incidents we saw at Mugello last year, but and then noticeably like that big dramatic restart when everybody kind of plowed into each other. But Bottas, like I think he was quite cagey and quite sneaky the way that he did that. And it was interesting because I think that he really caught out Lewis Hamilton, and that put him at a disadvantage, which Max took advantage of. But then it was interesting how it just sort of flipped around a number of laps later when Max had his own mistake, which put him at a disadvantage. And you don't give an advantage like that to Lewis Hamilton and expect to get away with it. And ultimately, Max paid for it. But I mean, Lewis had to earn that race win. It's one thing to look at it. Oh, well, yeah, Lewis wins again. I mean, he had to make two very good passes on two very good drivers and very good cars to gain back where he started from and ultimately take the lead in the race. And I don't think it was an easy race for him. I think he had a bit of a lead at the end. And of course, we had, this squabbling over the single point where both Max and Bottas pitted late in the race. Not like they were pushing him for that, the lead of the race anyways. But it was fascinating. I think there was beneath the surface, there was a lot to see.
We talked last podcast about the fact that Hamilton might be feeling a little bit of pressure this year. And we talked about how that could impact his performance and his racecraft and his strategy and how he approaches races. But what we didn't talk about necessarily, and shame on us, was possibly the pressure that Max Verstappen is feeling. And you have to wonder that, he's very similar to Hamilton in the sense that he doesn't make a lot of mistakes. Now, he's been cursed with some serious reliability issues, and you look at last year and the year before. Yep. Those are things that Hamilton hasn't necessarily really had to contend with outside of Malaysia in 26, which was obviously heartbreaking for all of Team LH. But you got to wonder that Max's mistakes this year probably aren't psychological, but I was listening to Jenny Gow and the Checkered Flag team earlier today talking about specifically this, and I think their interpretation is that Max is currently driving so on the limit in an effort to compete with Lewis, knowing that possibly for the first time in his career, he has the complete package. He has the power unit, he has the chassis, he has the aerodynamics, everything's working. But even that said, he still has to drive so on the limit that every single microscopic mistake is amplified. A mistake you make at 20 kilometers an hour is very different than a mistake you make at 290 kilometers an hour when you're challenging a driver going into a corner. And you absolutely nailed it. Like Hamilton, and I don't know that I want to necessarily criticize him or suggest that restart was a mistake. He was certainly caught out. Bottas was a little bit sneaky. He had a great restart. Max ultimately was able to capitalize on the fact that Hamilton was, and he wasn't asleep, but he was unprepared for Bottas's start. But again, that mistake that Max made, ultimately trying to get Bottas to take the race lead, is the one I think that probably resonates with me the most, right? Max had made a great move on Hamilton. Hamilton didn't have a great restart. Max moves into second. Max is biting at Bottas, waiting for that mistake. Bottas had the mental wherewithal to withstand that, but ultimately it was a mistake that Max made that made him fall out of DRS and territory that then enabled Hamilton to sneak in and take that position back. And I think you're absolutely right that Hamilton has obviously been an exceptional driver the past 6 or 7 years, but he typically hasn't had to make multiple overtakes in the course of a race to win the race, right? Hamilton didn't qualify on pole. He qualified well, but he didn't qualify on pole, but he had to overtake another driver in a car that's the equivalent of his in Bottas, but he also had to pass Max Verstappen to get this win. So I think obviously it was a very, very well-deserved race by Bottas or by Lewis, apologies. But I think ultimately what this race speaks to is that we could be seeing the beginning of an epic battle this year. Again, knock on wood, everything goes well, all the teams have great reliability, but we could really be seeing the beginning of an epic all-time campaign. And fingers crossed, I know F1 wants this, Liberty wants this, all the television partners want this.
We want this.
So we have something to talk about in October and November. But so far, this is shaping up excellently. And I think the one other comment I'll make, and I know you're dying for me to pass it back to you at this point, but I think the one other comment I'll make as well is I put out a tweet on Twitter on Saturday, said, hey, how many of you think Bottas is going to choke up the lead by the end of the first lap? And overwhelmingly, I think 80% of those people that responded said he probably would. Of course, I think that's in jest, but I also don't think this was a terrible weekend for Bottas. I think the expectation is like, hey, if you qualify on pole in a Mercedes, you're going to win the race. But I think we've all now made peace with the fact that Bottas isn't Lewis Hamilton. He's not Max Verstappen. And perhaps there shouldn't be that expectation that he's going to be able to fend both of them off over the course of 66 laps to win that race, even if he finished on pole. And I personally made peace with that. And I'm not necessarily disappointed with his performance. And he did what he needed to do. He finished on the podium. He collected a whole bunch of constructors' points for this team. And I think for Mercedes, that's probably enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just want to go back because I thought that discussion that we had, or you were just making about Lewis and the pressure and Max and the pressure and driving to the limit, is that we have to remember that these are two drivers at two very different stages in their careers. Of course, there's a big age gap in there. Lewis in his mid-30s, Max in his early 20s. And Max, I mean, this is the first time in his career, like you say, where he has the complete package and he's able to challenge for a world championship. So he's learning this as he goes along, whereas Lewis, yeah, sure, he hasn't had a lot of competition. He hasn't had a lot of pressure a lot of the time over the past several years, but he has the benefit of all these years in Formula One, all these years in motorsport, all this racing that he's done throughout his life to kind of fall back on. And maybe it's not like ultra fresh in his memory because, you know, he hasn't really been pushed, especially over the past couple of years. But certainly, I mean, he's been through it before throughout the course of his life. So, I mean, he does have that benefit. But yeah, I think that you make a really great point in bringing up the fact that Max is really absolutely pushing to the limit and every little mistake is going to be amplified. And like you say, I mean, that the perfect example was that little mistake that he made that dropped him out of DRS range with Bottas and then put him in the danger zone with Lewis in the DRS zone with him. But what absolutely astounded me was just the difference between the delta between the top, like the straight line speed between the Mercedes and the Red Bull. Because when the Mercedes had the DRS, I mean, it was like Max was standing still, that overtake that Lewis made on him. And the thing was that when Max was behind Bottas and he had DRS, DRS was only really kind of keeping him in touch. I mean, he wasn't closing anything. I mean, there were a couple of times that when you go through that new DRS zone between turns 4 and 5 on that little short straight, he kind of closed the gap up. I think about its smallest was about 3.5 tenths, 4 tenths of a second or something like that. And even around the back going into the main DRS zone on the start finish straight, he was at maybe 0.6, 0.7 of a second. And then when that DRS flap opened, he just was not able to close any distance between himself and Valtteri Bottas. I know that they said that I think that DRS zone was something like 120 meters shorter, which doesn't really seem like a lot at 290 kilometers an hour. But still, it would have made a little bit of a difference. But looking at that difference in straight line speed, I don't think that 120 meters extra would have made a big difference for Max, because it wasn't just like he was that close and just needed that extra little bit of asphalt just to make that, be in the position to make an overtake. I think he was just hanging on whenever that DRS was enabled.
It's an interesting point you make. And if you flash back to lap 20, that's the lap where Hamilton sneaks up. Well, it doesn't really even sneak up on Bottas, but he storms past him. It was it was very much the same thing, where obviously in that moment, Hamilton had DRS and obviously Bottas didn't. But the speed at which he closed in at Bottas on that lap was just remarkable. And I even made a note here during the course of the race that he was basically a second back, half a second past, gone. Just gone. And he absolutely just kills him around the outside, which is a tougher overtake oftentimes because you literally have to cover additional territory, additional ground to make that overtake. But it wasn't just necessarily that the Mercedes had great pace today, is Hamilton in particular had monster pace, yeah. Absolutely monster pace. And to your point as well, I know that Max was mentally, psychologically in the position of kind of recovering from that mistake he made when he was trying to get into DRS range to overtake Bottas. He makes a mistake, but Hamilton's on him so fast and passed him so fast. It's remarkable. And I don't think we should discredit the work that Honda and Red Bull have done to put together that ultra efficient, compact, high horsepower power unit. That's a lot of words, but I think we've probably not given enough credit to Mercedes for the fact that they're going to be able to extract comparable amounts of power from their package, despite the fact that they're obviously having some high rake drag issues themselves. But I thought it was very, very, very telling. But overall, I'm excited by what I saw simply because it continues to feed this narrative that we're going to have a very close Constructors' Championship and hopefully a very, very, very close Drivers' Championship as well over the course of the 21 campaign.
Absolutely. And Mark, that's a great place to leave it for the moment. We're going to take a quick break here and we're going to come back and we're going to keep breaking down the 2021 Portuguese Grand Prix. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. We are talking about the Portuguese Grand Prix. And Mark, one thing that I wanted to talk about, which I thought was quite interesting, was some of the comments that came out of Red Bull just regarding the time deletion for Max's fastest lap. Because he pitted on what? Lap 65, right at the end there to change onto the soft tires to try and steal that fastest lap and that single point away from Valtteri Bottas and Mercedes. Ultimately, he did go wide at 10:14. He was informed in the post-race interview by Paul Di Resta from Sky, and he made the comment, "Oh, that's odd," or something like that. Then they start complaining about all the inconsistent application of track limits. I mean, they said right from the beginning that they were going to be enforcing them at turn four, but it turns out to be a little bit of fake news from Max, because apparently on Saturday, race director Michael Massey in the FIA said that they were going to enforce track limits at turn four. So this was something that either he forgot or they didn't pay attention to. But the point is, whatever the story is, they were all informed that that was going to be enforced. And there was a number of times that were deleted. I mean, even Yuki Tsunoda was warned from the pit wall, even though he wasn't challenging for the lead. But I mean, he was warned fairly early on in the race that he had exceeded the track limits a couple of times. And if he did it again, he was going to be in the penalty zone where he would be getting the 5 seconds. Penalties and things like that. So I really don't have a problem with that. I mean, if you're cheering for Max, you're cheering for Red Bull, you're going to be a little bit disappointed, but it is a self-inflicted wound, more or less, don't you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it was pretty clear to all of the drivers and all of the teams, and by all accounts, it was discussed and clarified during the virtual driver's briefing this weekend, that those were going to be enforced on those specific corners. And I think ultimately, obviously, Verstappen was penalized because of exceeding track limits in qualifying. And I would have assumed that he was going to be much, much, much more sensitive to that going into this race. And ultimately that point was kind of stolen away from him. And I think if I flash back lap 66, and correct me if I'm wrong, but lap 66, it was ultimately Bottas that put in the fastest lap. And then almost immediately Max put in the fastest lap.
Correct.
But there was no second guessing on the broadcast. Like if I recall, like even during the broadcast, the Sky team knew immediately he'd exceeded track limits and they immediately rescinded the point. So especially him finding out the way he did seemed a little bit odd to me, because the broadcasters and everybody at home knew immediately that that time was being deleted for exceeding track limits. But, I don't think that they're playing ignorant here, but I just think they had to have known. They had to have known.
Yeah, well, I mean, Helmut Marko, he said it was annoying, just the application of the exceeding track limits. But we've been through this drama before. I mean, after the first race, yeah, there was some legitimate complaints to be had with the inconsistencies of the application of track limits. But in the remaining or the subsequent two races, I think that they've been pretty. I think they've been pretty much on the ball. I mean, we've seen it all weekend long. And the point is that the track is from the one white line on the left side of the track and to the other white line on the other side of the track. And if they decree that track limits are going to be enforced at whatever corner or corners on a race weekend, I think that it's become better over just the short amount of time that we've seen pass over the first couple of races of the season.
And it's not just the application of the adjudication, the officiating during the race. It's also how they transparently communicate how they're going to be officiating track limits before the race itself. And I think maybe some of the misses in the past is, one, they were only enforcing it intermittently in race, which I think we saw in Bahrain, which I think was a real problem, right?
Yeah.
Which was ultimately the Mercedes cars were blatantly disregarding track limits for the first half of the race. And they could, because nobody was enforcing it. And then ultimately they began enforcing at the end, which was, I think, unfortunate and led to days or if not weeks of conversation about how poor the enforcement of track limits were. But yeah. I think they're doing, and this is by all accounts and based on everything I've heard, they're doing a much better job of being very clear with the teams and the drivers about how and when and where they're going to be enforcing track limits. So it shouldn't necessarily be a surprise. It shouldn't have been a surprise to Max during qualifying, and it shouldn't have been a surprise for him on lap 66.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, if you look at the entire quote from Dr. Helmut Marko, he says, quote, "Now we've lost the victory, fastest lap and pole position. All things good come in threes. I hope that's the end of it. Something has to change. Either you make a boundary with curbs or you make it gravel or something. If you go out, there's an automatic penalty. Lando Norris overtook Sergio Perez, went over with all four wheels, and there were no consequences. So it's not consistent, and that's not racing when you juggle the rules like that," end quote. Yeah, I mean, I can maybe understand to a certain degree that that the move that Lando made. I mean, I know that Perez got the position back, and there was a bit of discussion on the commentary that maybe McLaren made him give the position back. You know, he slowed down because, I mean, all of a sudden Perez really found an extra margin of speed, because I mean, you have to remember that this McLaren isn't a pushover, right? I mean, it's got a Mercedes engine in it. It's a decent car in its own right, but I mean, there was nothing overtly said. You know, we didn't hear anything on race radio. I mean, there was no investigations by the stewards. So I'll give him that. But I thought the one thing that he said that really kind of stood out, that I thought was a bit weird, was either you make a boundary with curbs or make it gravel or something, because then, you know, if they did something like that, then the next thing is one of his cars goes over and gets breaks a piece of suspension on these big curbs, or puts the wheel into the gravel and he's out of the race, and then they'll be talking about these stupid curbs, the stupid gravel traps, whatever it might be. So I can understand he's a little bit frustrated, but still, I don't completely agree with everything that he's saying there. I mean, it seemed like you said that it was pretty clear cut, and I mean, at the end of the day, it's only for one point. It was the stupid fastest lap of the race point, which they kind of introduced, what was it, about 3-4 years ago or whatever it was. You know, I can understand that maybe it has it's kind of a neat thing in its own right, but I'm who's really going to remember next year that Lewis Hamilton won this race and his teammate got the fastest lap of the race? I mean, we might remember because we're having this discussion now, but I mean, I couldn't remember who got fastest lap of the race 2 weeks ago at Imola. So,
you know, I think this is actually a really good point to interject. We actually had a listener on Twitter actually tweet at us a couple of days ago specifically about the fastest lap point. And BJ Crabtree, shout out. Thank you for tweeting at us. But he specifically asked that thing. He said, you're going to have to explain this fastest lap concept to me. Quote unquote, doesn't seem very sporty if you ask me. I say that respectfully, by the way. Hamilton is still the best. So impressive. Another great weekend. But I think his point was, it seems strange and it seems a little bit gimmicky. And to be fair, if we want to start unpacking gimmicky parts of Formula One, we need to go and look at DRS right away.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
I think, and I'd love your perspective on this, I really think that the fastest point was injected into the sport as a mechanism to keep people interested at the end of a race that Hamilton was winning by 20 seconds, right? Like, to me, that's the conclusion that I drew, which is, hey, how can we find a way to inject some excitement into the end of the race when the conclusion is a foregone, and outcome is a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, it always kind of had that feel, right? But when I thought, where my thoughts was when it was introduced was, it seemed a bit silly. It's just like, are really people going to get out of their seats because Sebastian Vettel is going to get a single point for setting the fastest lap of the race, or, you know, Charles Leclerc or whoever it might be? So it's... I could understand trying to maybe generate interest in other ways, but I thought for the sake of a single point, maybe if it was for 5 points or something a little bit more substantial, it seemed, you know, no pun intended, pointless for 1 point. But it does add a bit of a dynamic now that like we were saying right off the top of the show that both Mercedes and Red Bull were so hyped up to fight over this thing right at the end of the race that once Bottas went to change the tires and Max basically had a free pit stop to do the same, it really seemed kind of odd We haven't been in this position. Maybe this is what they were hoping for when they introduced it, that there would be some competition or the constructors, the drivers' championship would be closer than it was when this thing was actually brought in a couple of years ago, that there would be a situation where they would be fighting it out. And maybe this is the first time we're seeing this concept, you know, proven in reality right before our eyes. So it'll be one thing to look at Spain and all the races from here on out, or maybe this will be the one anomaly that will forever stick in our minds when they finally do away with it, if they do away with it, and we'll say, it was good in theory, but we only ever really saw it come to fruition in Portugal in 2021 and never again and never before, right? Yeah, you know, certainly is it's a funny one, but I do think that regardless that the single point going to Bottas and Mercedes, I don't know if 1 point is going to come down to it at the end of the year, but I'm getting the feeling now that unless something drastically changes, that the margin between these two teams, however, whichever way it goes by the end of the way or the end of the year, I think it will be fairly close. And that's what I'm hoping for. I don't think it's going to be a single point, but I think it'll be a lot closer than it has been.
I'm thinking about this now. You're right. Like if you think about it within the confines, or if you compartmentalize the idea into a single race, you're right. It's a single point. But over the course of a 20 or 22 race calendar, if you as a team are able to pick up 10 fastest laps, that's 10 points.
Yep.
That's not insignificant in the context of a constructors' championship. Right? Like that definitely changes the dynamic a little bit. I still think it's a little bit manufactured in the sense that, again, look at the two cars that were competing for the fastest lap today. Hamilton's up 5 seconds. Nobody's going to catch Hamilton. So you have these two cars that effectively take a free pit stop. They change tires. They don't need to change tires for any other reason than the fact that they're going to chase the fastest lap because they don't have a shot at the race win and the podium's effectively decided at that point. I think that's the part of it that I don't like, is that it's so manufactured, right? Like you had two cars that took an unnecessary pit stop in the effort of trying to put in one fastest lap. Like, I'm all for awarding a point for a fastest lap, but I'd love to see it in the vein of the race itself. Mm-hmm. When the cars are actually on the track competing against each other, those seem, what we saw today when they were able to pit on lap 64, whatever it was, I know you mentioned it earlier, but what we saw today when they pit on lap 64, they get fresh tires. It's basically they're putting the car in party mode and just going out for their Q3 run.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It seems very manufactured, and it seems very circumstantial in the sense that, hey, we just happen to have the opportunity today because we weren't going to win the race and Hamilton was 5 seconds up. And then the other thing it does too is it distorts, in a sense, the outcome of the race. Like, if all you looked at was the race classification today, you see Hamilton win by 30 seconds, but that itself is artificial because you had two cars pit to change tires.
Yeah.
It's very, very strange. And then I think ultimately, if you look back, and Formula One is, it's like baseball in the sense that they relish history. They talk about the past. They talk about previous champions. They talk about corners on racetracks, statistics, points. It's very, very, very important in the historical context of the sport. And the sport's history is very important in informing how decisions are made today and the way the racetracks are built and the way people attack corners, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it does influence the way ultimately people will reflect back on the history of the sport, right? Like, if you look at, like, hey, what was the average time that Hamilton won a race over the course of his career? Well, yeah. That number is now artificial because you have cars intentionally taking 30 seconds out of a, like, I'm going to stop ranting because the more I unpack this into my head, the more I dislike it. But I thought that was a great tweet, and it really had me thinking. And we won't get into it now, but just as much we could talk about DRS being artificial in the sense that you're artificially injecting an opportunity for a car to pass when maybe that wouldn't have been there before. But that's for another day.
That's off-season discussion when we're hurting for, you know, content to totally. And news and things to put out. Anyway, so let's take another break here, Mark. We'll come back. There's still a number of interesting stories to talk about in this race. And first of all, I want to talk about how Max hopes this is the last time we will see Formula One at Portimao. Anyways, we'll talk about that in just a moment, so don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, yeah, just before the break there, I was I dropped a little bit of a teaser, but Max Verstappen says that he hopes that Formula One's not going to come back to Portugal and to Portimao, and it's not necessarily for the reasons that you might think. Well, I guess it depends which way you're thinking, but it's not for maybe the not ideal race weekend that he was hoping for. Anyways, Max was he was really complaining about the level or the lack of grip that he had around the circuit, and basically because of that, he says that he hopes Formula One does not go back there. He says he believes that Barcelona, which is where the Spanish Grand Prix is next up, he says that's a good track. He says it's a good track that's well suited to Formula One, and then he says he believes there as well we'll really get a good sense of how everybody's have progressed so far in the season. So yeah, you know, it seems like a little bit of an overreaction. I know I said last podcast that I thought that Portimao is a nice track, maybe not ideal for these modern Formula One cars, but certainly I think it's got some good characteristics to it. I mean, the commentary team were comparing it to a roller coaster with the change in elevation, which I really like. I really like that sweeping right-hander when they come out of turn 14 or turn 15 onto the pit straight there. That is certainly, I think, pretty cool. That's a good one to watch. So, I mean, it does have some plus sides. And of course, I guess if you're a driver, then of course, you know, some of the nuances and some of the things that make your life and your job a little bit more difficult, like grip levels, certainly are going to be something that either you like or you don't like. And obviously he was not very happy with that, but certainly we did see other things too, like wind come into cause some guys issues throughout the weekend. But I don't know, what do you think? Would you like to see Formula One go back to Portimao?
Thank you for asking that question. It's funny, when I was preparing for the podcast, I actually wrote out a list of kind of the top themes that I wanted to address on the pod. And yep. The number one theme for me was the track. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I liked it last year, and I know we talked a couple of days ago about how undulating the surface is, yep. And that term, and I even wrote it down here, roller coaster. It has that feel, and it has that sensation. It looks good on TV. It challenges the drivers. It creates some opportunities for passing because drivers are more likely to make a mistake than they would on a flat track. I thought it was fantastic. Now, to speak to that Max Verstappen comment, that surprises me a little bit. Obviously, he had some comments throughout the weekend about the surface. So last year, when they were at this track, drivers complained that the track was too bumpy. The surface wasn't great. If the track's bumpy, one, it's incredibly uncomfortable for the drivers because these cars, for all intents and purposes, have no suspension and they have no cushioning in their seats. So if the track is bumpy, they feel it. The other challenge with a bumpy track is the cars lose a significant amount of grip and downforce if the track is poor. So they resurfaced it, which is good. But the problem is they resurfaced it recently, which made it ultra slippery. And I thought that was Max's biggest complaint. And you saw a little bit of it, I think somewhere around lap 36 or 37, when Bottas had pitted, he managed to come out in front of Max. Max was on tires that were a lap newer or a lap older, but he'd had some heat in those tires. And if you remember, Bottas steps out, or as the back end steps out, partly because of cold tires, partly because the track was a little bit slippery. But I'd actually heard some comments, and it was an interview from Max earlier today speaking to the fact that, hey, I actually really like the track. The surface wasn't great. It was really great. So when I saw the story that you were referring to, I thought the same thing. It's like, feels like it's a bit of an overreaction that ultimately it's a great track. It plays well. It looks great on TV. I think we'd spoken to the fact that it wasn't necessarily engineered with Formula One cars in mind, but that said, we saw some overtaking today, and ultimately tracks that aren't necessarily engineered for Formula One cars don't necessarily facilitate overtaking, but we saw that today. So I thought it was great. Now, in terms of Max's comment about Spain, he obviously has warm feelings for that track because that's where he won his first Grand Prix back in 2016 after the silver Mercedes cars took each other out right at the beginning of the track. But I was surprised by that comment, and I thought it was a bit of an overreaction, and I don't think it's necessarily a good look when one of your top drivers is saying, hey, I hope we don't come back to this track. That's really dramatic and unnecessary, and it doesn't do a lot to foster the goodwill of the spectators in that country who didn't actually even get the opportunity to attend a race. I'd really love to see Portugal with 100,000 people in the stands. I would love to see that, but I love Austria, and I spoke to this last Thursday. I love it because of the elevation gain and the elevation depreciation, and I love this track for the same reason. And again, you can't compare this to Austria in terms of the elevation component, but I thought it was a great track, and I hope they find a way to keep it back on the calendar, even if it's on a semi-reoccurring basis.
You know, it's kind of funny because you make that comparison to the Red Bull Ring at Spielberg, right? And I always get the same vibe watching these two tracks. They're fairly short, they're fairly compact, but I mean, if you look at the lap times, I think at the Red Bull Ring, I think they're running, what, about a 1 minute 13, something like that. Whereas this one, it was 119 and just a little bit shy of 120, I think, is where the fastest lap of the race came in. So it's a touch longer. I mean, they kind of fold back in on themselves. So it's a little bit longer than you think. But yeah, I think the one real thing that kind of stands out is exactly like you say, this track was designed not with Formula One cars in mind. But that being said, these are supposed to be the best racing cars in the world. They're supposed to be up for the challenge. So, I mean, it's not like they're racing on some ridiculously impractical street circuit or go-kart track. I know that's like a terrible comparison, but it's for me it works. And like I say, I'm on the fence whether or not it's the ideal Formula One track. But like you say, when you make that comparison with the next venue in Barcelona, and I've been to the Spanish Grand Prix. I mean, it's a great facility. It's a great place to go and watch a race. But the thing is that these guys, they've been to that track a million times. They've done their winter testing there for years and years and years, and they could basically drive the circuit with their eyes closed. And just the layout of the track itself does not really lend to too many passing opportunities. And that's where I think that that Portimão has the advantage. I think that last year we saw something like 58 or 60 overtaking, like over the course of the entire race, which is just shy of one a lap. I don't know where it came out this afternoon, but that's not bad. I mean, that's actually pretty good. I mean, there's been quite a lot of action on the track. And the one thing is we saw the leaders changing position. We saw quite a number of overtaking throughout the field throughout the afternoon. And I think that's what people
want to see, right? I mean, we want to see we want to see overtaking. We want to see drivers competing. We want to see drivers fighting for position. And that's why, I mean, like I say, I mean, I've got fond memories of going to Spain in person, but classic races at Barcelona, they've kind of been a little bit far and few between, and sometimes maybe for the wrong reasons. I mean, 2016 stands out as one of the exceptions because you have that memorable crash at turn three on the opening lap between Lewis and Nico Rosberg. They're out, and then the stage is set for this young new hotshot, Max Verstappen, to step in and take his first win in Formula One, right? I mean, so that's one of those ones that sort of stands out, but the racing there can be somewhat plain and, well, I mean, dare I say vanilla, you know, that plain and, well, I like vanilla ice cream, so I shouldn't say it's boring, but it tends to be not the most exciting track on the circuit, on the calendar, I should say.
I really don't have anything else to add to that. And my sense is, to me, there's some vanilla tracks in the series. China's one. And obviously, we didn't get an opportunity to see China last year. We didn't get to see China this year. I think what sets Barcelona apart, or the Spanish Grand Prix apart, is especially when Alonso's in the series, there's a certain atmosphere there that is very MotoGP like. And I know I was messaging you about this the other day, but the MotoGP circuit typically has 18, 19, 20 races. They have four different races at four different tracks in Spain, and the atmosphere is, it's bonkers. It's kind of a cross between a Formula One race and a football match between two really premier football clubs. The atmosphere is bonkers. And I think one of the things that I've always liked about the Spanish Grand Prix is it borrows a little bit from that MotoGP vibe, which is much more driver-centric, I think, even than you would typically see at a Formula One race. And not to go on a totally different tangent, but if you go to a MotoGP race more, and you're starting to see a little bit of this in Formula One, they'll have entire grandstands that are reserved for the supporters of a specific driver. And everyone in that grandstand has to wear the same color, and they wear banners, and they cheer for that driver. Like, it's a very different vibe, but I think that's what makes the Spanish Grand Prix exciting. And I'm excited to see it this year, although less so the last couple of years because Alonso's back. I just want to see how the crowd reacts. Of course, that's going to be muted because of the current health and safety situation. But I agree. To me, Spain historically has been a little bit vanilla relative to some of the other tracks that we see.
Yeah, I mean, having said that, I mean, it's a wonderful place to go and watch a race because, I mean, Barcelona in itself is a fantastically awesome city full of amazing things to do. And well, that's all I have to say about that, because then I'm going to start burning out material to talk about in our preview show for the Spanish Grand Prix. But moving along, one of the things I think was interesting at the end of the race, one of the storylines from the race, was I would have given a slight edge to Red Bull on the medium compound tires. But when they switched to the hard compound tires, I think that the advantage was much clearer, that that the Mercedes was better on the hard compound tires. Excuse me. But the one thing I thought was very interesting is in that last kind of closing stage of the race, that that Max, he was ahead of Bottas, but it was looking as though that he might get close enough at some point to actually be within striking distance. And who knows, maybe if might have been able to make an overtaking maneuver on him. It didn't turn out that way, but it turned out that there was a sensor issue that caused power loss. And then he dropped back to about 4.5-5 seconds, and it kind of stayed there because before they had those sort of manufactured 30-second gap to Lewis there because of the pit stops, we kind of had like 5 seconds kind of spread out between Lewis to Max, and then 5 seconds from Max to Valtteri. So it was kind of funny because it's one of those things you typically don't expect to see with a Mercedes. I mean, at the end of the day, I guess you could say that the damage was somewhat minimized because they still had 1 in 3. They got the fastest lap points. So yeah, I think they obviously would have won a 1-2 finish, but it wasn't an absolute disaster finish for them.
No, I completely agree. And I think the team's ultimately happy with the outcome. The fact that Bottas was on the podium was a good news story. It is fairly interesting. And somebody had texted me about this earlier today. It's like, Lando's third in the driver's titles or driver's standings. I'm like, well, to be fair, Bottas had a DNF. So I think they were probably more than happy that he was able to cash in on some points and didn't ultimately get himself tangled up with another driver that ultimately lost them all the points. But yeah, I agree. I always find it remarkable that teams are able to diagnose these issues on the fly and resolve them so quickly. Like, to me, like, it's terrible that it happened, but the fact that they've got the telemetry and they've got all of the insightful data that enables them to identify the issue and rectify it is pretty incredible. But I think you're right. Like, ultimately, I don't think it necessarily swayed the outcome of the race. And I think they would have left a 1-2, but I think they're ultimately satisfied with a 1-3.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I want to take one final break here. And then when I want to come back, I want to talk about a couple of other stories. I think we've talked about the big two teams long enough. And I want to come back, just want to touch on a couple of other things. And we'll do so in just a moment. So please don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. We're breaking down the 2021 Portuguese Grand Prix. And we should have done this off at the top, but the final race classification for places. Well, we'll just do the 1-10. Lewis Hamilton, Max Verstappen, Valtteri Bottas on the podium. You had Sergio Perez. Not bad. I mean, I think this is where they wanted to see him, or on the podium. Anyways, Checo in P4 for the Red Bull. And then you have Lando Norris, Charles Leclerc, Esteban Ocon, Fernando Alonso, Danny Ricciardo, and Pierre Gasly rounding out the top 10. A bit of a disappointing race for Carlos Sainz. He had a fairly decent qualifying and he had a fairly decent start to the race, but at the end, he dropped out of the points. I mean, he qualified in fifth, three places ahead of his teammate, Charles Leclerc, so a bit disappointing for that. And then just looking at the Drivers' Championship, Lewis Hamilton, 69 points, 8 points ahead now of Max Verstappen. Like you said, Lando Norris, third in the Drivers' Championship on 37. Valtteri Bottas is fourth with 32, and then you have Charles Leclerc rounding out the top five with 28 points. And then on the constructors side, you have Mercedes with 101, Red Bull 28, no, sorry, I can't do my math here. They're on 83 points. So, like I said, they're dropping back a little bit, but the gap is not insurmountable at this point. Then you have McLaren with 53, Ferrari with 42, and then Alpine with 13 points to round out the top five. So we have three teams that have not scored a single world championship so far, or world championship point so far, I should say. That is Alfa Romeo, Williams, and Haas. Anyways, I wanted to touch on a couple of stories here as we start to wind the show down. Aston Martin. This is the first one. So I was encouraged. I was disappointed that Lance did not make it out of Q1. I was a little bit more encouraged that I was finally seeing Sebastian Vettel in Q3 for the first time in literally 300 years. So that was positive.
15 races.
15 races.
Silverstone was the last time he got into the Q3.
That's a long time. Anyways, it was good to see one of them in Q3. So I thought, well, maybe there's something here. Maybe Seb can get some points, but by the time it was all said and done, they just it was another disappointing weekend for them. I mean, there was no reliability issues. Sebastian didn't drive up the back of somebody, but he said at the end that he just did not have enough point or pace to score any points in Portugal. And he said even as early as 10 laps, it was difficult to keep touch with the cars in front of them. And he said he just couldn't stay with them and just basically lost out. So that is very, very disappointing. And I don't know what to say at this point, really. I mean, they've underwhelmed and really disappointed to a degree I was not prepared for. Let's just put it that way.
I was going to make a point a couple of minutes ago when you were talking about Carlos Sainz and Ferrari. And I think ultimately the Carlos Sainz finish was disappointing because Ferrari, I think, very much sees themselves in a battle with McLaren for third place in the Constructors' Championship. And trust me, yeah, I'm going to work my way back to Aston Martin somehow. But ultimately, I think we're going to see two stories this year. One is going to be Red Bull potentially fighting Mercedes for the title, the Constructors' title. But I think we could also see a really good battle between Ferrari and McLaren for third place. So I think those points that Carlos potentially, I don't want to say forfeited, but those points that he wasn't able to cash in on today was a big deal. But what's kind of scary right now is if you look at the Constructors' Championship, you have Mercedes 101 points, Red Bull 83, McLaren 53, Ferrari 42, Alpine 13, AlphaTauri 9, Aston Martin 7th place, 5 points through three races, and Sebastian Vettel still hasn't scored a point. And to your point, yeah, he breaks through to Q3, and we're thinking, finally, psychologically, that must be a massive relief for this guy. And maybe he's going to be able to unleash something on the track on race day that we haven't seen in a while, but ultimately to finish 14th. Was he finished 14th today? Yeah, 14th. No, sorry, Lance finished 14th, and ultimately Sebastian Vettel finished 13th. But to lose three places, for Lance to finish out of the points, it was a horror show. And obviously, they didn't have mechanical issues.
Yep.
This was just they didn't have the pace on this track, and it's not shaping up to be a good year for this team. And it's honestly almost to the point where they're not a part of the conversation. And if you hadn't
brought
Sebastian Vettel up, I don't think we would have mentioned them. And I don't think this is where they want to be, that three races into the season, we're not even talking about them. Like, we're not talking about McLaren enough, but we're not talking about Aston Martin at all because they haven't earned our attention.
No, they haven't. You know, it was funny. The one point I wanted to make earlier in the show was that I think that, all season long, we're going to see at some tracks, Red Bull will probably have a slight advantage. And then at other tracks, the Mercedes will have a slight advantage. And the thing is, you would expect that one car, we have two challengers like that. The other will be slightly better suited to one track or another. But the one thing that we're seeing with the Aston Martin, three races in, it's not suited to any of the tracks that we've been to so far. And it looks like that they just got it so wrong and they were affected so much by these changes to the aero rules this year that it's just messed them up so much. And it went back to the point that we made on the podcast either this week or last week that, it was one thing for them to really think outside the box and exploit the rules last year to their advantage with the whole pink Mercedes thing. But on the flip side this year, they've been so completely caught out on the other side that it's really, it's been a complete reversal in fortune. It really is staggering because, we're talking about them, like you say, because they are not giving us a reason to talk about them. But in effect, they are, because we're talking about them because they've just been so bad.
I'll put this into context as well. And I think a lot of our newer listeners may not understand this, but prior to becoming Racing Point, this team was known as Force India. And Force India was a team that was run on a shoestring budget. The team entered administration back in 2018.
Yeah.
Lawrence Stroll, Lance Stroll's father, swooped in. He bought the team out of administration. He did the right thing. He kept all the staff. He promised to invest in the team. He did it. But when they went into the 2019 season, because the team was effectively bankrupt throughout the 2018 season, they didn't have the money to build the new car for 2019. So the car that they took into the 2019 season was basically the 2018 car. And the point I'm trying to make is that three races into the 2019 season, when they were running a car that was a year old, they had more points than they do now, three races into a season where they have the best power unit in the sport and a chassis that they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars developing. Like, this is a shocking start to the season. And I think the issue is, you can't see the end of this, right? Like, if it was, hey, they've had some mechanical issues, they had a couple of DNFs, Lance made a mistake, he crashed out, you could start to paint a picture that there's light at the end of this tunnel, but they're finishing these races. They just don't have any pace whatsoever.
Oh, I know. It's absolutely incredible. And just one other thing that I wanted to talk about, just a lack of pace. I mean, our good friend Nikita Mazepin, he was making the headlines again, I guess, to a certain extent this time. We're standing out for all the wrong reasons. I mean, he ignored four blue flags when Checo Perez was leading the race. And, Checo was lucky he didn't lose his front wing. I mean, Mazepin, properly assigned a 5-second penalty for that. But I was going through and looking at the fastest lap times that were set. So Bottas, his fastest lap of the day, set on lap 65, was a 119.865. So the only person that didn't set a fastest lap was Kimi Raikkonen, because he actually didn't complete a lap. So Nikita Mazepin, he was the 19th fastest driver on the day. His fastest lap was a 123.6. So, I mean, that is an absolute, to say it's a country mile in terms of difference is just staggering. But I mean, you look at Mick Schumacher, his fastest lap was a 122.755. I mean, he's 9/10 of a second faster than his own teammate. Okay, granted, the Haas probably isn't the best or the fastest car to begin with, But that delta between the two teammates, and those two times were set only three laps apart. Schumacher set his fastest lap on lap 61. Mazepin was on lap 64. God only knows how far he was in the final race classification. Pardon me. I know he was way down by the time it was all said and done, but that is just a shocking thing. I mean, he was two laps down. I mean, both of them were, but that's staggering. That's a huge.
I have to be careful because I don't want it to seem like I'm just piling on for the sake of piling on. Yeah. But I think both you and I were extraordinarily skeptical about what Nikita Mazepin was going to be able to bring to this team in terms of performance this year. And to be fair, the Haas is the slowest car on the circuit. I'll be very honest. Lewis probably wouldn't be able to bring this car out of Q1 in any qualifying session this year. And that says a lot. But I think what we're seeing with Mazepin is not only does he have horrendous pace, it's just the lack of self-awareness on the track and the impact that he's having on other people's races. And I'm actually really glad you brought up the Mick Schumacher point as well. I think one of the really good news stories for Mick today was he was actually in a race. And, yep. And by that, I mean, he actually legitimately finished ahead of another driver who themselves finished the race. So I thought it was really good that Mick is in a position where he overtook somebody. He finished not dead last, but he finished 17th, and it was a well-earned spot. So I think that was good for him and his development and his psychological well-being. But I think the other story here too is, and I'm not sure if you plan to get to this, but ultimately it was another disappointing weekend for Williams. Nicholas Latifi obviously struggled through the practice sessions. Russell had an okay qualifying, and I think that there was a thought that maybe this is the race that they're going to break into the points, but the race ultimately spoke otherwise. But yeah, kind of talking to Nicholas Latifi, he had a really bad exchange with Mazepin also in qualifying, and I don't know if you picked up on this, but there was a point where he was cursing on the radio, and Latifi's not the type of person that curses, but Mazepin brought it out of him. But ultimately, again, tough weekend for Williams. They finished behind a Haas. George Russell was in a position to score points this weekend. He finished 16th. Just another disappointing weekend overall for the Williams team.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny because I know that they were really kind of buoyant that maybe they might score some points this weekend, but I just kind of had a bit of a bad feeling after I watched qualifying on Saturday that George, you know, Mr. Saturday, who's such a regular it's a bit of, and I mean that in the best possible way. I mean, I'm not being sort of sarcastic or anything, but I mean, he's been so good to get into Q3 so many times in a car that really isn't, suited for that sort of thing, but he just sort of missed out. And I just kind of had that sinking feeling for him because I can't remember exactly how much he missed out on progressing further in qualifying, but it was a very small amount. I think it was under a tenth of a second, so a very, very small time difference. So it was disappointing for him. But I mean, on the flip side, at least for Schumacher, that was very good. I mean, he was really quite positive about it. He said that he felt like the car had a lot more pace this weekend. He felt that that there was a lot of momentum that they got out of that, and he really feels that if things keep going, that this car is going to be much, much better by the end of the year. I mean, ultimately, we're going to get completely brand new, radically different cars for 2022. I mean, that's a completely different conversation, but you know, he seems pretty positive about that. And I think that, for himself also being, pretty young driver for season in Formula One, then he's going to take that away from him. And this will be, I think, a race that will really make a good impression on him so early in his career, even though, like you say, I mean, he's well down in the running order, but you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. You know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. I mean, take whatever, comparison you want to make. But I think it was a positive result for him nonetheless.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's ultimately good for the sport. I think they want whatever opportunity presents itself to put him in a marketable position. And I'm happy for him. I think ultimately, obviously, I'm a little bit biased because I want to see the Canadian drivers do well. And yeah, this weekend, they weren't on the radar ultimately whatsoever.
Yeah. And just finally, the last one I wanted to get to was Fernando Alonso said that he was fueled by anger to get into the points at the end of the race, pardon me. And he actually ended up in P7. I think actually that Alpine was a bit of a surprise because at one point during the race, I kind of had the feeling that it didn't really look like it was going too well for them. I think ultimately it may have changed out or ended up a little bit better than expected, but Fernando kind of showing a couple of little things here and there. I mean, P7, I think, was decent. I think slowly but surely he's getting back to, you know, where he wants to be. But still, I think that, you know, being fueled by anger is kind of an interesting comment from Fernando.
It doesn't surprise me. I think if you know Fernando and how passionate it is, or he is about racing and his racecraft and the results, I think this probably doesn't come as a surprise, but I thought it was a really solid drive. And ultimately, Alpine, I have to be careful, I almost said Renault, but Alpine finished with a P7 and a P8. They were able to cash in on a double points finish. They're currently sitting fifth in the constructors. And like I said, they're significantly behind the P4 team right now, but I think it was a nice tidy weekend for them, and I think they're continuing to build, right? Like if you look at their first race weekend, they finished 13th and they had a retirement. In Imola they were 9 and 10, and then this race weekend they were 8 and 7. So they're continuing to build, and I think based on what we saw out of that package last year, that there's potentially some podium potential there. I hate to use the word potential twice in a sentence, but there's certainly podium potential there if the circumstances are right, whether it's race, whether it's there's some damage on cars up ahead of them. But I wouldn't be surprised to see one of the two drivers on a podium this year. I kind of like to see Alonso, and I'm not an Alonso fan, but I think it's an interesting story to talk about that he leaves the sport for 2 years. He's 72 years old and he's able to come back and secure a podium. But yeah, I think it was a great news story for Alpine as well, that they're continuing to build some momentum after a really tough opening race weekend in the Gulf.
Yeah, actually, I misspoke. It was his teammate Esteban Ocon that came on
P7. I didn't want to say it.
I said it, and then I'm just like, I better just double check my notes here because I think I got that wrong. Yeah, so he was P8, and basically what he was saying is he was fueled by anger after what was a bit of a disappointing qualifying. So yeah, I mean that'll certainly be one to watch because I think that where they are in the constructors in P5 is not. It's not too shabby, but, you know, I mean, they're well back of a Ferrari. I mean, Alpine only has 13 points in the constructors for P5 and Ferrari has 42. So, I mean, if they want to start moving up and challenging that that next tier of the best of the rest, then they have their work cut out for them. But I think, like you say, that there is maybe hints that if things go right, that things could work out for them and they might be able to sneak a podium or two here or there. I mean, they did last year. I mean, we saw Danny Ricciardo then in the guise of Renault on the podium a couple of times later in the year. So who knows? It would be, like you say, a really kind of interesting story, a really good talking point to see 72-year-old Fernando Alonso. Is he like the Tom Brady or the Gordie Howe of Formula One? It certainly looks like it. But good story nonetheless. Anyways, Mark, I don't know. That's about all I got, in terms of this one. Like you say, it was a bit of an interesting race because on the surface, it doesn't look like there was a lot to talk about. But when you really dive into it, there were some really meaty, interesting stories to talk about. And it certainly leaves us wanting more for Spain coming up next on the schedule. And I just wanted to give a shout out to a couple of listeners, Carlos Hernandez, Eli Thacker, and also to Chris Lee, all in touch via the email over the past couple of days. We'll get around to those emails. They asked some really good questions, raised some really good points, and we'll save those for the pod in a couple of days. You know, they're more suited to the longer form show. As I look up and notice, we're already pushing 60 minutes here.
For did you say the email?
Yeah.
Or the fax machine wasn't available. I'm just teasing. It's almost 11 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So I should check.
I'm pretty sure we don't have a fax machine around here anymore. But you know, it's actually kind of funny you should mention that because we actually on some of our office correspondence we have a fax machine, but I haven't checked the fax machine in the office in literally years. So who knows? There might be an important piece of documentation somebody from 1987 has faxed through to be at work one of these days, and it's just been sitting there because nobody's checked it. But anyways, on that note, we will shut it down there. Thank you guys for watching on YouTube, listening to the podcast. Thanks for getting in touch. If you want to do so, easiest way is on Twitter at @ScuderiaF1Pod or email at @ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. And that's a wrap. Enjoy your week. We'll be back in a couple of days. And until then, take care and bye for now.